On the day before the week of the trial, Blomqvist stopped at the Pressbyrån newsstand at Slussen and read the headlines for the morning papers. Svenska Morgenposten's CEO and chairman of the board, Magnus Borgsjö, had capitulated and tendered his resignation. Blomqvist bought the papers and walked to Järva on Hornsgatan to have a late breakfast. Borgsjö cited family reasons as the explanation for his unexpected resignation. He would not comment on claims that Berger had also resigned after he ordered her to cover up a story about his involvement in the wholesale enterprise Vitavara Inc. But in a sidebar, it was reported that the chair of Svenskt Näringsliv, the Confederation of Swedish Enterprise, had decided to set up an ethics committee to investigate the dealings of Swedish companies with businesses in Southeast known to exploit child labour. Blomqvist burst out laughing. And then he folded the morning papers and flipped open his Ericsson to call the woman who hosted She on TV4, who was in the middle of a lunchtime sandwich.
"Hello, darling," Blomqvist said. "I'm assuming you'd still like dinner sometime."
"Hi, Mikael," she said, laughing. "Sorry, but you couldn't be further from my type."
"Still, how about coming out with me this evening to discuss your job?"
"What do you have going?"
"Erika Berger made a deal with you 2 years ago about the Wennerström affair. I want to make a similar deal that will work just as well."
"I'm all ears."
"I can't tell you about it until we've agreed on the terms. I have a story in the works. We're going to publish a book and a themed issue of the magazine, and it's going to be huge. I'm offering you an exclusive look at all the material, provided you don't leak anything before we publish. This time the publication is extra complicated because it has to happen on a specific day."
"How big is the story?"
"Bigger than Wennerström," Blomqvist said. "Are you interested?"
"Are you serious? Where shall we meet?"
"How about Semir's cauldron? Erika's going to sit in on the meeting."
"What's going on with her? Is she back at Millennium now that she's been thrown out of SMP?
"She didn't get thrown out. She resigned because of differences of opinion with Magnus Borgsjö."
"He seems to be a real creep."
"You're not wrong there," Blomqvist said.
Clinton was listening to Verdi through his earphones. Music was pretty much the only thing left in life that could take him away from dialysis machines and the growing pain in the small of his back. He did not hum to the music. He closed his eyes and followed the notes with his right hand, which hovered and seemed to have a life of its own alongside his disintegrating body. That is how it goes. We are born, we live, we grow old, we die. He had played his part. All that remained was the disintegration. He felt strangely satisfied with life. He was playing for his friend Evert Gullberg. It was Saturday, July 9th, only 4 days until the trial, and the section could set about putting this whole wretched story behind them. He had gotten the message that morning. Gullberg had been tougher than almost anyone he had known. When you fire a 9mm full-metal jacketed bullet into your own temple, you expect to die. Yet it was 3 months before Gullberg's body gave up at last. That was probably due as much to chance as to the stubbornness with which the doctors had waged the battle for Gulberg's life, and it was the cancer, not the bullet, that had finally determined his end. Gulberg's death had been painful, and that saddened Clinton. Although incapable of communicating with the outside world, he had at times been in a semi-conscious state, smiling when the hospital staff stroked his cheek or grunting when he seemed to be in pain. Sometimes he had tried to form words, and even sentences, but nobody was able to understand anything he said. He had no family, and none of his friends came to his sickbed. His last contact with life was an Eritrean night nurse by the name of Sarah Kitama, who kept watch at his bedside and held his hand as he died. Clinton realized that he would soon be following his former comrade in arms. No doubt about that. The likelihood of his surviving a transplant operation decreased each day. His liver and intestinal functions appeared to have declined at each examination. He hoped to live past Christmas. Yet he was content. He felt an almost spiritual, giddy satisfaction that his final days had involved such a sudden and surprising return to service. It was a boon he could not have anticipated. The last notes of Verdi faded away just as somebody opened the door to the small room in which he was resting at the section's headquarters on Artillerygatan. Clinton opened his eyes. It was Vardenshu. He had come to the conclusion that Vardenshu was a dead weight. He was entirely unsuitable as director of the most important vanguard of Swedish national defence.
He could not conceive how he and von Rottinger could ever have made such a fundamental miscalculation as to imagine that Wardenschuh was the appropriate successor. Wardenschuh was a warrior who needed a fair wind. In a crisis, he was feeble and incapable of making a decision. A timid encumbrance lacking steel in his backbone, who would most likely have remained in paralysis, incapable of action, and let the section go under. It was this simple. Some had it, others would always falter when it came to the crunch.
"You wanted a word?"
"Sit down," Clinton said. Wardenschuh sat.
"I'm at a stage in my life when I can no longer waste time. I'll get straight to the point. When all this is over, I want you to resign from the management of the section."
"You do?" Clinton tempered his tone.
"You're a good man, Wardenschuh. But unfortunately you were completely unsuited to succeed Gulbeck. You should not have been given that responsibility. Von Rottinger and I were at fault when we failed to deal properly with the succession after I got sick."
"You've never liked me."
"You're wrong about that. You were an excellent administrator when von Rottinger and I were in charge of the section. We would have been helpless without you, and I have great admiration for your patriotism. It's your inability to make decisions that lets you down."
Wardenschuh smiled bitterly.
"After this, I don't know if I even want to stay in the section. Now that Gulberg and von Rottinger are gone, I've had to make the crucial decisions myself," Clinton said. "And you've obstructed every decision I've made during the past few months."
"And I maintain that the decisions you've made are absurd. It's going to end in disaster."
"That's possible. But your indecision would have guaranteed our collapse. Now at least we have a chance, and our plan seems to be working. Millennium doesn't know which way to turn. They may suspect that we're somewhere out here, but they lack documentation and they have no way of finding it, or us. And we know at least as much as they do."
Wardenschuh looked out the window and across the rooftops.
"The only thing we still have to do is to get rid of Zalachenko's daughter," Clinton said. "If anyone starts digging around in her past and listening to what she has to say, there's no knowing what might happen. But the trial starts in a few days, and then it'll be over. This time we have to bury her so deep that she'll never come back to haunt us."
Wardenschuh shook his head,